This is a recording identification. I'm David Hedberg from Portland State University. Today is March 3rd, 2012. I'm at the home of Lee and Barbara Mason, and we'll be doing an oral history interview for the Silicon Forest Project from Washington County. Lee, could you tell me your date of birth and your place of birth, please?
January 5th. 1929, Elrose, Saskatchewan, Canada.
Excellent, thank you. Could you tell me about how you came to the Pacific Northwest?
Well, yes, it's fairly involved. That's, well, how many minutes do I have?
Well, you can have as much as you want.
Okay, well, I was came from a very fortunate family. My dad was the telegraph operator for the Canadian National Railroad. So we lived in the railroad station right beside the tracks. And I was born just before the Depression hit. So we were living there all through the Depression in this station house that furnished us with everything. Coal, water, ice, electricity, and maybe some other things that I can't think of right now. So my dad taught me how to be a telegraph operator, so I learned how to do that when I was about 10. And then when we left Elrose and lived in two or three different towns in Saskatchewan. And then when I, between my, I'll back up a little bit. In 1943, it's at the height of World War II, my brother Glenn and I came to Portland to work in the shipyards for the summer. That was between about grade 7 and grade 8, I think, for 2 months in the summer. And we were making about a dollar an hour. And even adults in Saskatchewan, if they had it, well, they were having work then because the war had started, they were probably making 25 cents an hour. So we worked all summer and saved our money. So we went back and we got involved with a little band and stuff, bought our own instruments and everything. So we lived in three towns, Hanley, Saskatchewan, Punichai, Saskatchewan, and Nokomis, Saskatchewan, where we learned to ski, and we had a band in a couple of towns. We played hockey and curling. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with curling or not. It's done right here in Portland now. So then, getting a little bit farther ahead. Between grade 11 and grade 12, when I was 17, I came down to Portland again. Went up to the big station in Portland, Union Station. I'm sure you know where it is. And I took the elevator up to floor 2, where the dispatching offices were for the Southern Pacific Railroad. And I was in there and applying for a job. So I was treated so well, a fellow all in a suit and everything brought me in, and in about 10 minutes interview, he took me into where the guys were telegraphing and gave me a little test, and that was very easy for me, and asked me about some of the rules on the railroad, how to keep trains from crashing and all this and that. Well, the rules are a little different in Canada than in the States, but very similar. So he said, well, I'm going to send you to Woodburn, Oregon to learn our way, the Southern Pacific way. So, and that was such a nice little town then. Mm-hmm. That was 1946. So the funny thing about that, there was an agent there, and a day operator. Normally in smaller towns, you just have the agent that does the telegraphing and selling tickets and express and freight and all that. But it was fairly busy, so they had an operator there. So the agent introduced me to the operator, and he had a unique name. Do you remember what it was, Barbara?
Oh, I don't. Sorry.
Oscar. It was Oscar. Well, I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, I said, well, I said, oh, Oscar Froese, F-R-O-E-S-E. So I said, well, you know where I come from? In Hanley, Saskatchewan, there was some Froese's there, although I pronounced it Froese, because that's the way we pronounced it up there. Mm-hmm. Oh, he said, that's where my relatives are from. So anyway, he had a car, and he drove me around. We played tennis and introduced me to people that I should know. And I didn't have any money. I had $5 with me, but he found me a place to get room and board, and very nice lady. I think I could still find the house in Woodburn. It was right beside the tennis court. And so the first day I went in, there was a cafe right across the street from the station. The station is no longer there, but you can see where it was by the sidings and so okay. on. So anyway, I went in to have something to eat, and I only had $5. So I looked at the menu, and they had sandwiches for 25 cents, real, but they had a hot beef sandwich, and I'd never heard of it before. Sounded real good, and I had to think about it for a while because it was 45 cents. I don't remember if that included coffee or not. But anyway, I ordered that, and it was very good. And so I was, being as I'd worked for my dad so much, I quickly learned. So in about 4 days, they got a call from the chief dispatcher in Portland and said, we need an agent at, I'm trying to think of where it was, Toledo, Oregon. Okay. Actually, he said, we need an operator at Toledo, Oregon. I was both an operator and agent. So he put me on a bus. I was only there for 4 days learning the business. And I went to Toledo and stayed in the hotel there. And a man came to visit me. The agent in Toledo came to visit me. He was a man about 45, seemed a little old at the time to me. And since then, I've wondered about him because he met me very nice, but he saw this skinny little kid, 115 pounds, soaking wet, 115 pounds, and he was going to turn the station over to me to run the next day. But not really, because it was a little bigger station. There was a chief clerk there and another operator. Well, as it worked out, the operator would be the agent and I would be the operator. But I had to get up real early in the morning and open the place up about 6 o'clock in the morning. It was about a block away. Am I going on too long?
No, 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 not at all.
So anyway, I went down there. And they had found me a place to stay near the high school. And, I went to sat down in the telegraph office. I'm the first one there, nobody around. So I knew I had to telegraph. And the lines from, I think they came from Eugene, the telegraph lines, to Toledo. And there was trees overhanging them. So when they were telegraphing, you'd sometimes miss the dots. You just had to guess, well, was that two dots and a dash or was that one dot? But I had some pretty good foresight. We had to copy these train orders that told the trains where to meet. Mm-hmm. So if you made a mistake, you could actually run those trains together. There was no signals like there are nowadays. They just went by these train orders that we hooped up. You're probably familiar with that, are you? Mm-hmm. And so anyway, I had the foresight to go through some previous train orders and see what the names of the towns were, because they would say a certain train would meet another certain train at Myrtle Creek or something like that. So you had to know how to spell it. If you knew that, and then you're reading the telegram, and it starts out with M-Y, oh, you pretty well know it's Myrtle Creek, even though they missed the odd letter going mm-hmm. along. So that was very helpful. I didn't make any mistakes. Never crashed any trains. So anyway, I was there for 2 weeks relieving the operator who was relieving the agent. And then the operator was going on his vacation for 2 weeks. So I was there for a month. And then they were sending me to, on the main line, south of Eugene, to a place called Wicopee, Wicopee. It was just a place where they had a passing track and a few shacks where the operators lived and where the section foreman would live. So the agent at Toledo was very nice. They provided us a large trunk full of dishes and everything, because there was no cafes or anything. There was nobody lived in the town except the railroad people. No town there, maybe about 15 people maximum. So he told me all the stuff I should get, canned stuff and so on, so forth. So when I got there, I was totally exhausted. And they stopped the train to let me off. The trains would never stop there. They stopped the train to let me off. And I introduced myself to the afternoon operator, who was a lady. They had a fair number of lady operators during the war, which I'd never met before. Up in Canada, we had no lady operators. And she was very nice. But I mentioned the hoops that you have to hand up to the engines. And in most places, you have these wooden hoops that are shaped like that. I can draw one for you later mm-hmm. on, about this size. And when you get these train orders, you clip them on like a little, what kind of a clip?
Like a
the wooden clip, you know, that you use.
Like a clothespin. Yeah.
Clothespin, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Clothespin. And set. So when the train goes by, you hand up one of these hoops up to the engine and one to the conductor. But this town, Wicopee, was on the highest grade of any railroad, I believe, in the United States. It was about a 2.5 grade, just remembering it. And most the railroads do not want to exceed 2% grade. So this meant that coming out of Oak Ridge, Oregon, they put on helper engines. Mm-hmm. Now the freight trains would have about three extra helper engines on there to pull maybe 50 cars. But the passenger trains, they would put at least one, sometimes two engines on. So that meant there had to be a lot of train orders handed up. So the way it worked there, you went outside the office, and right beside the track there was a tower with a ladder that went up about 8 or 10 feet, so you could put these hoops on an automatic thing that stuck out towards the engine, and one was lower for the conductor. But so I would have to, if a passenger train was coming along, I would have to put up train orders for the engineers and one for the conductor. Well, so getting back, I was exhausted when so this lady operator showed me this new type of hoop where you had to thread a, like a binder twine. It was a spring-loaded thing, and you had to thread binder twine through it and attach the train orders to the binder twine. So I just come to work at midnight and took over from this lady, and things were very quiet until 1:05. There was a yellow light came on in front of my desk, And so I called the dispatcher in the Eugene. We were on phones there, not telegraph. Mm-hmm. I called him and I said, you had to know which trains were coming. You could tell by your schedule. I said, number 11 just hit the yellow light. Oh, he said, well, clear him. And now that means that I put, so I read off about, okay, I said, clear number 11 with orders numbers 6, 8, 10, 12, about four or five different orders all had numbers. Mm-hmm. All these train orders on my desk. And he said, oh, he said, wait a minute. I might change the meat. So, okay. So then I'm waiting while he's deciding what to do. And pretty soon I'm looking out the window and I can see the headlight of the train coming less than a mile away. So I said, hey, the number 11, I can see the headlight. Oh, clear them. Okay. So I have to read these train orders out. And he said, okay. And his name, I remember it was A.J. Green. So he said, okay, A.J.G. And fine. So I run, right, turn around and run to these hoops. And they're spring-loaded, and I have a string that I have to put on and put the order in, tighten it up, and I get one done. I got two more to do, and the engine goes by. Well, now they can't keep going because they have a red board, mm-hmm. and they can't go unless I hand up the order. So all of a sudden, I hear these two engines screeching to a halt, and it was the daylight. It was our fastest train we had going down to Oakland, actually. All these beautiful yellow cars going by, yellow and orange cars. And by the time the last car got just in front of my station, they got stopped. Well, by then I had all the train orders put together, and I ran out and ran way up. There was a little gravel path, fortunately, right beside the track. So I ran up to the first engine, the engineer, which would be the helper engine because they just put him on the front, and handed him up this train order, and he took it. And I thought he's going to chew me out, didn't say a word. Then I came back to the regular engineer with on this real nice, beautiful orange. The engine is the one that's important now.
Oh, okay.
4440. Mm-hmm. I have millions of pictures of it. And I handed it up to him, never said a word, probably thanks. And then I ran back to the conductor and handed him in, never said a critical word. And then, because it's on this steep grade, both engines. And then away they go. So I come in and said to the dispatcher, number 11 arrived at 1 o'clock and left at 1:02. What did you stop him for? Well, I didn't have time. You remember? You didn't clear him till I could see the lights of the engine. Okay. He was kind of mad. And I said to myself, I haven't heard the end of this. So the night went all through, no problems. Lots of trains going left and right, and no problems. Now that I had the dispatcher cleared these trains as soon as I told him to hit the yellow light. So no problem. But 8 o'clock when I'm getting off and turning everything over to the day operator, there was a side phone that just rang and said, this is Vern Field, the chief dispatcher in Eugene. What did you stop number 11 for last night? So I went through the little scenario, and he was still mad. He thought it was my fault. And, you know, it wasn't my fault at all. I was quick to admit if I ever made an error. So he said, well, okay, but don't let it happen again. And so these fellows were all worried because anytime he stopped a streamliner, they had to send a report right to the general manager, the superintendent, the high mucky mucks of the Southern Pacific Railroad, which would be ridiculous because he would have made that time up in about a half an hour. He would have been on mm-hmm. time again, but he had to do that. So that's what brought me down to Oregon. I guess that was your question. So that was my first time in Oregon. No, that was my second time. I'd come down for the shipyards, and then I came down for this job.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up with you about working in the shipyards.
Oh, good.
You know, it sounds like you were quite young when you came down.
Well, actually, when I came in 43, I was too young to work in the shipyards. But my brother, Glenn, he was a couple of years older than me, and he had to be 16 to work in the shipyards. And so he got on the shipyards, and I went out and picked berries. I have some stories about that. But that's so on the shipyards, then the next year when I came out, I hired out. And that's when I made the dollar an hour. And because I didn't make that much picking berries, for sure. So I was a burner. Now, burner, you learn to be a burner before you become a welder. Maybe you're familiar with burning or not.
No, welding, but not
well,
burning.
Being as I was, this was so interesting about the shipyards. In Portland, this was 1945, I guess, yeah. I maybe made an error there, but it doesn't matter. So it was in 45 when I was working for them. And so they hired me out. You just had to sign up, hire out, we'll find something for you to do. So they hired me as a burner, and I went on graveyard shift and met this old foreman that was probably 50 years old, real nice guy. And he said, well, this fellow will show you how to be a burner. So he took me out and handed me this, looks exactly like a welding torch. I think it's probably the same thing. But you don't weld, it's just got this hot flame coming out, and you can adjust it to get it just right. Well, I was pretty handy, so I learned right away. So I had about a five-minute instruction how to be a burner. So then they said that when you begin, these ships had double bottoms. Double bottoms started after that famous ship went down. What was the big one that they made the movie about?
Oh, yeah. I can't think of the name.
You know the name of it.
The Titanic.
The Titanic.
Oh, all right.
Apparently it wasn't, if I got the story right, it wasn't double-bottomed. So after that, I think even I think there was a sister ship to the Titanic, and I think they took it back in and put double bottoms on it, but I might be wrong on that. So the double bottoms, there's the original bottom, and then about we'd say maybe 2.5 feet below is another bottom, with this airspace between it. But they had crossbars, like they were steel, about a half inch steel by 2 inches by maybe 3.5 feet long, that they used when they welded all this stuff together. So but they didn't want the weight in there. So my job was to go down there and cut these things out. And I just left them on. Somebody else would come and pull these bars out later. But most people that did welding and burning had leather pants. Well, I was just a kid. I didn't have any money to buy leather pants, so I just had my own pants. So about every 20 minutes, I'd smell smoke and see my pants were on fire, so I just, with my hand, knocked the fire out and kept going. So I was there for almost 2 months and earned some money and went home. And it was a wonderful job. In fact, what they did, they were so good, about maybe the latter part of July is when Japan surrendered. But they still kept building the ships because you can't just shut things off. So most people, the older, they wanted to quit and go and find a job somewhere else. And they knew that us younger guys, they would want a few bucks, you know, which was big money to us. So they kept us on right till the end of July when we had to go back to school. So I thought that was pretty nice of them. And
how many ships a day were they making?
Well, at the end, we were launching a ship a day, I think. We were building 12 ships at once. They were called ways. You've seen them on TV where they lower the boats. So you just start with these big 12 by 12s or whatever it is, going into the water. And then you see that the ship is partially built up with the double the double hulls sitting on them. Most of the stuff was prefabricated, and they had moved this double hull onto the ways. And then the next one was half built up, and the next one was two-thirds built up. And when you got to the 12th one, it was launched. And then, of course, they'd start building there with a new one and so on. So we just kept rotating around. But in the, and the, we started out building, when I went there July 1st of 45, we were building Liberty ships. Mm-hmm. But they switched over to Victory ships. And at the last of the war there, we were launching a ship a day.
Wow.
They got, Henry Kaiser was the fellow that uh-huh. started the ships. Mm-hmm. Now, it might be interesting, my first cousin, Wynne Clark, and his wife, Onley Clark, were the two first aid people there. Wynne Clark was a doctor, and his wife Onley was a nurse. Mm-hmm. That is all the doctors and nurses they had.
Really?
I imagine there was 10,000 or more
wow.
people there.
Wow.
Clock around.
Of Kaiser,
yeah, man. Right.
So then, this was Henry Kaiser uh-huh. that owned the shipyards. He had them all across the country. And his wife, I believe it's called Kaiser Permanente, because I believe his wife's maiden name was Permanente.
Oh.
So it's called Kaiser Permanente Hospital now.
Mm-hmm.
So at first, he wanted to start this, his wife wanted to start this hospital. And the doctors were all resistant of it because that's socialized medicine. And they resisted it, but he kept going on it. And after a few years, the doctors just loved it because now they don't have to take care of any paperwork. They don't have to hire nurses and secretaries. They just have to go and be a doctor. So we're still with Kaiser and very happy with it, mm-hmm. although it's getting way too expensive. They've, in the last few years, they've hired chief executive officers, and the first thing they do is surround themselves with more people and more money, mm-hmm. and there's so much money going out for administration. Henry Kaiser would just roll over in his grave because mm-hmm. he was an efficient guy.
Mm-hmm.
He put lots of people on a job, but they had to be efficient, no extra people. Anyway, that's a little bit about the shipyards.
Yeah.
Was that enough?
What were you working on VJ Day?
I was working on VJ Day, and I can remember it like it was yesterday. Well, I don't know if I was right in the plant on VJ Day. I think I was at home. In fact, was it on a weekend? I don't remember exactly when they mm-hmm. announced it on the radio. We didn't have TV then. But anyway, my brother and I, and a friend of ours that was down with us, my friend from Elrose, Saskatchewan, he worked for the Safeway during the summer. We went down to Interstate Avenue, where the buses run quite regularly from Kenton.
All right. Mm-hmm.
The little town of Kenton, which is still there and very similar to the way it was in mm-hmm. 1945, the main street. So went down there and caught the interstate bus that went into Portland. And there was all kinds of big bands, just like Harry James, and like it was all across the country. And the Dorsey Brothers, but Portland had several big bands. They were on flatbeds going right down Broadway playing all these songs. And then you would, what we had in those days, instead of TV, you had newsreels.
Mm-hmm.
There was one movie house right down in the heart of Portland that all they showed was movie tone news all day long, and it was updated every day, just like television is now. So of course we went to that, and it would show all these sailors and the famous sailor that kissed this girl. You've seen pictures mm-hmm. of that mm-hmm. on Life magazine. I'm not sure if we saw her, but it was exactly the same in Portland. The streets were full of sailors and soldiers. And getting back to the station, when I applied for that job, the station was full of soldiers because they were going on troop trains and stuff,
mm-hmm.
totally full of soldiers. And the station, I was just down there a couple of days ago putting my brother on, The station today is exactly the same as it was then, except I went up to the second floor, and now the whole station is owned by the city of Portland. Mm-hmm. And so they're refurbishing the upper floors, but I see the same door that I went through to be hired out, and there is a communicator up there that works for Amtrak, I guess. I had a little visit with him, but it's nothing like the old days, no telegraphing or anything.
So after you worked for the Southern Pacific, what did you do afterwards?
Well, I'll finish up how I was. My last job in the Southern Pacific was Clackamas, Oregon. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the station is still out in a field about a mile north of where it used to be.
Oh, really?
That they were going to turn into a museum. Mm-hmm. I doubt that it'll ever happen. But anyway, I was... Now, they needed an agent, somebody that, a lot of the operators weren't agents. They didn't know how to sell tickets and stuff like that. So we had a supervisor of agents, the nicest guy you ever met. So when I worked at various places, if I ever had a problem, I just call him up. Oh, yeah, this is how you do that. Okay, so he took me out to Clackamas. And showed me the ropes. There was a lady station agent there that had never learned to telegraph. She went back 40 years, so she couldn't handle these train orders and stuff. She was just more or less selling tickets and stuff. So they were so happy now to have her, so we could give train orders to these trains going out just as they left Portland. Sometimes they don't get out of Brooklyn Yards is where they start out. Have you heard of Brooklyn Yards? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that, incidentally, is where that 4440 train is, the
okay.
engine.
Yeah.
They store it there. So he showed me the ropes of the place, and this very nice lady, I think her house, she just lived a block away. Station is gone, but I think her house is still there. I'm going to drive by one of these days. Anyway, so the next morning, I get on way over. By this time, my brother had moved out of Vanport. We first of all went to Vanport.
Okay, yeah.
So my brother moved over to St. John's, so I had to get up about 4 o'clock in the morning, catch a bus into downtown Portland, and take another bus that went towards Kamloops, Clackamas.
Well, good.
On,
here, I'll pause for a minute.